Welcome to We Know a Guy Radio, a production of Bear Media Consultants, the place to go if you want to get connected. I'm Denny Griffin, and I'll be your host for this hour-long variety show featuring topics ranging from organized crime to entertainment. My guests will include former mobsters and retired lawmen, entertainers, writers, reporters, and successful businessmen and women. You can participate in tonight's show through our chat room or by calling in at 646-478-0982. My producer, Kim Colton, is manning the switchboard. Hiya, Kim.
Hi, boss. How are you doing?
Good. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Going to be a great show.
It certainly is, and let's get right to it.
Okay.
What would you do if you received a phone call 28 years after your father's murder and a friend told you they finally knew who killed him? You would venture forward to bring the criminal to justice and clear the case. However, good guys aren't always the heroes, and bad guys sometimes aren't villains. That's what happened to Paul Sharpe when his former babysitter read the biography of a career criminal turned government witness. In his book, the former mobster described the killings of Paul's father and his female employee that took place in McHenry County, Illinois, in June 1981. It was the same information he had given to the FBI and McHenry County officials in 1982 as part of his debriefing after becoming a government witness. But for unknown reasons, McHenry County failed to act on what they had been told. The revelations in that book rekindled Paul's desire to resolve his father's killing and started him on a journey that raised serious questions about the investigation conducted by McHenry County Police at the time of the slayings and in the intervening years. His experiences in the pursuit of justice resulted in the newly published book, Murder in McHenry. And tonight I'm pleased to welcome Paul Sharpe and his co-author Keith Bettinger to the show. Paul and Keith, welcome.
Hi, Denny.
Hi,
how
Denny.
Are you?
And Paul,
I just want to say hi, Paul. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, Kim.
Sorry, Denny. The books arrived, and I'll be giving Frank his book tomorrow.
Perfect.
Okay, let's start out talking a little bit, Paul, if you will, to set the stage for the listeners in the background. First, tell us about your dad, Rod Sharpe, and Pat Freeman, who was his barmaid.
Sure. On June 2nd, 1981, my father was gunned down with Patricia Freeman, his employee, at our bar, the PM Pub, which is located in Lakemore, Illinois, which is about 40 miles northwest of Chicago. At that time, the case went cold. It went unsolved for 27 years, even though the McHenry County Sheriff's Office had a suspect that they were keen on, a gentleman named Glenn. Glenn was the boyfriend to Patricia Freeman, and he was known to be very jealous and sometimes get violent when he was in relationships. He was kind of a loner. And that was one of the biggest reasons why the sheriff's office was keen on him as a suspect. But like I said, the case went cold for like 27 years later, and my former babysitter, Holly Hager, was taking her father back down to Arkansas from Illinois. And in that car ride, she asked her father, Jim Hager, who do you think killed Ron? And Jim would definitely have some insight. He was my dad's best friend. And what he mentioned to Holly was Glenn, Pat's boyfriend, and a gentleman named Larry Newman. So Holly got back to Illinois. She started Googling Larry Newman. And the first website that he came up on was a serial killer site, and it mentioned that he was from McHenry, our hometown. She Googled a little further, and then she traced Larry back to a book, Collada. The book Collada was about a former gangster turned government witness, Frank Collada. So Holly went and purchased the book and read it. And on page 130, without the names of my father or Patricia, she read The Murder of My Father. So she then took the book and the information she got on the web, and she sent it to her father, Jim. Jim looked over that information, and then I received a phone call one day. And me and Jim were talking, and eventually, just out of nowhere, he said, "You know who killed your father, right?" I said, "I didn't know. If it was in today's paper, I missed it. Tell me." And he said, "It was Larry Newman." And then he started bringing up Tony Spilotro, Frank Collada, the movie Casino, the Hole in the Wall gang, and more or less overwhelmed me, where I had to go ahead and take notes and kind of figure things out. What I found out, the information that Jim was providing was correct, and that started my pursuit of justice of getting Larry Newman named as the killer of my father and Patricia Freeman.
Larry Newman, now he's an interesting individual. He was convicted, and I believe in the mid-1950s, for murdering three people in and just outside of a Chicago tavern. And my understanding is that he was got in an argument with a bartender and a waitress over allegedly being shortchanged about $2. And he went out to his car, got a shotgun, he came back, killed the bartender and the waitress, and then there was a gentleman, a young man, who was just delivering newspapers to the street newsstands, and he just happened to be walking by the door when Newman was leaving the bar, so he shot him as well. And he received a sentence, I believe was 112 years in state prison, and miraculously he was paroled in about 12 years and ended up back on the streets. Is that basically your understanding of some of Newman's past history?
Yeah, I believe he was sentenced for 125 years, and I believe that's correct. I think he was paroled after 12.
And now, Paul, I've never lived in Illinois, but you have. There are certain stories about that I've heard over the years about dead people voting and these types of things. And is it possible that if somebody had, going back into the 1970s, for example, and 60s, if someone had enough money or influence, could a triple murderer, could a parole board or some be influenced to let a triple murderer do an 120 or 125 years out on parole? Would that be a possibility? Apparently it happened in Illinois.
Well, yeah, you kind of beat me to the punch on there. It definitely happened, so that's what we have to assume. You know, but Illinois is notoriously known as being one of the most corrupt states in the Union. If it's not the number one corrupt one, nobody can think of who's more corrupt. And I think that's just embedded into the fabric of, you know, coming from Chicago, and I think it really relates to the influence of the Chicago outfit. They no longer have the influence that they did, but that's the way, you know, things get done in Illinois. It's corrupt. It's dirty. And, yeah, that seems to be very likely that Larry Newman's father, who was very wealthy, had influence on getting Larry Newman released.
Now, The other thing probably worth mentioning is, and in fact you just touched on it, about his Newman's dad being a wealthy man. Larry Newman, I understand, was receiving a trust fund, payments from a trust fund that his father had set up for him. And back then, all those years ago, it was a substantial amount of money. And Larry Newman didn't have to steal or kill or be a criminal to survive. I know a lot of times you'll hear stories about criminals and their environment. You know, they were poor, they didn't have anything to eat, and so on and so forth, and that the only way they could survive is to turn to crime. Now, that wasn't the case with Larry Newman. Am I correct on that?
That is the case. I've actually, you know, the rumor had that he was getting about $60,000 a year from his trust fund. You know, and then we're talking about the 60s and the 70s. That is a lot of money. It's decent money today. But I did get some better information through the Freedom of Information Act that it was approximately around $700,000 in total in the trust fund, and that his father didn't trust him, so he put a cap that Larry could not access more than $7,500 every 3 months. But that's true. That was more than enough money to live more than comfortably. But he chose to hurt, kill, maim, because he liked it.
That's a really scary thought. I mean, I'll tell you of this whole thing. Well, there are other things involving the investigation that we'll get into in a minute, but the very fact that a guy like this was out on the streets, I mean, after being caught and convicted in a triple homicide, I find that very upsetting. I can't get my head around that fact that this guy was able to get out in 11 or 12 years after being sentenced to 100 and whatever change.
It speaks to the level of corruption in Illinois. That's what it does.
But the governors make the best license plates.
That's right. That's right. That's where my governors retire.
Yeah.
Retirement home for governors.
That's right. Joliet
State
prison.
Prison.
Don't touch the fence around the governor's home.
Now, Paul, I think we're going to have a surprise guest on here in just a minute. And we'll can add a little bit to the conversation. Anyway, and just for the benefit of anyone not familiar with the Chicago outfit, the outfit in Illinois, in New York, they have the five families, the Gambinos and the Lucchese's and so forth. In Chicago, the organized crime family is referred to as the outfit. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And now you mentioned a few minutes ago Frank Collada. Collada was this career criminal who's biography Holly read, and in there on page 130 was the information describing, without the names, but describing the circumstances around your dad's and Patricia Freeman's murders. Have you ever met Frank Collada?
I have.
Well, okay. The good news is Frank is with us right now. Hello, Frank.
Hi. How are you?
Hey, Frank.
How you doing, buddy?
Hey, I've been doing pretty good. I'm glad to hear you're on the show.
Yes, good to be on here. Good to be on here.
Thanks for joining us, Frank.
My pleasure.
We've just been talking a little bit about the 1981 murders of Paul's dad and Patricia Freeman, his employee. And basically where we're at right now is that we've talked a little about Larry Newman and the murders he did in Chicago, where he got 100-plus years in prison and somehow got out after about 12. And then about Paul's former babysitter reading your biography, the Collada book, and on page 130 finding the description of the murders. And naming Larry Newman as the perpetrator, as the killer. So, Paul, after you received this information from Holly and from Jim, you went back full force to try to get the case resolved and the case cleared. And what steps did you take then once you had this new information?
Well, what I did is I actually went to the publisher and reached out to them, and I was reaching out to the co-author of Collada, Dennis Griffin, and I sent an email on, the public relations person sent the email to you on my behalf, and about 4 hours later after I sent my email, I received an email from you. And we talked a little bit, and we agreed that we were going to go ahead and talk on the phone the following week. But the very next day, I received an email from you, and you stated that you had spoken to Frank and Dennis Arnoldy, who is Frank's debriefer, an FBI agent, and you asked them, why didn't they turn this information into McHenry County back in 1982 when Frank turned? And they told you that they did.
Yeah, next to Larry Newman getting out of prison after you know, after those 10 or 12 years or whatever for that triple homicide, my next biggest surprise, if you will, stunner, was the fact that Frank had turned this information over to the appropriate authorities, you know, a year after the killings. And yet the case had gone cold. And I was just under the assumption when Frank was describing the murders that they were, you know, a done deal. So I knew Newman was in prison at the time and stuff. And I thought that's what it never registered with me that the authorities, for whatever reason, sat on this or didn't do anything with it for that amount of time. And I understand they had this other Glenn guy as a suspect. And, you know, obviously you got to consider all the possibilities. But, Paul, is it my understanding correct that they really didn't interrogate or interview Larry Newman about this, even after what Frank told them?
Well, you know, I filed for a Freedom of Information Act after the book was published. Actually, Keith filed for the same Freedom of Information Act two times, trying to get my father's file. And both times he was refused, but I guess the third time's the charm. And I got most of my father's file. And what I found was that Larry Newman was interviewed as a witness, okay? Not different being a witness than a suspect. And in his witness statement, he basically implicated himself. He actually said that he heard a rumor that he went down to Chicago and placed a contract on my father. That was pretty much the complete statement. He was never talked to again, or there was never any information in the file that he was ever talked to again. And the FBI was sending McHenry County information telling them where Larry was at. But that never went anywhere.
Well, you know, when I had the interview with them, I was locked up. And McHenry County came down there. I think he was in a couple of policemen or a policeman and the DA or whatever he was. And when I was telling them the story, they did not even ask me questions. I was volunteering all of this information to them, and they were looking at me like they really, really didn't want to hear it. And they ended the interview at probably about a half hour. And didn't take any notes or anything. I noticed I didn't see him writing anything down. And after they walked on, I said to the FBI guy, I said, that was the strangest interview I ever had. I said, these guys don't look like they're concerned. And he says, yeah. He says, we're going to have to follow up on this to see what's going on there. I said, well, maybe they think I was lying. I said, but I have no reason to lie about something like this. And I was there when Larry got the call from his ex-wife. And that you got strangled or something by this, you know, man that owned the lounge, whom I didn't know. I didn't know anything about him. I just told Larry, why do you want to go back there and bother this guy? I mean, your wife is not even married. You're not even married to her anymore. And he said it was out of disrespect. Well, after talking to him for probably a good half hour to an hour, he agreed with me that he wasn't going to do anything about it. Larry I would call Larry a serial killer. He enjoyed doing crazy things.
Thank you. And
I do want to make clear.
I did follow up on that because I did talk to the other, later on, years later, I did talk to, I think after Mr. Sharp over here got on it a lot, it drove these other detectives that were in charge there then at the time. Not at the time of the killing, but they took over after these other guys retired, I believe. And I talked with them and had several meetings with them on the phone. And they seemed more receptive in what I was saying. And I told them Tommy Amato and then the guy Tommy Amato that Larry was with. And Tommy Amato wouldn't budge on it. You know, he didn't, no matter what you told Tommy Amato, he just wasn't going to go along with the truth. And he more or less backed off, and they even offered him immunity from prosecution. They said they could get it to him. And he said, well, I have nothing to say. So that's where we left off, and I don't know what happened. I even understand that they went to Kentucky to talk to this Debbie woman that was married to Newman at the time, and that's all she did was talk about me. So they were all ducking.
Frank, I want to make one point clear, if I could, Denny.
Sure.
The folks that went out to talk to Frank was George Hendel himself, the lead investigator, and Illinois State's attorney, Ted Floral.
Okay.
So you had the state attorney and the handling or the lead detective.
That's correct.
You know, I didn't pay attention to their names. I just knew they did tell me their names, of course. But I was just relaying something over to them that I knew for a fact took place. And their names went right out of the window. I didn't pay any attention. I just knew they were officials from McHenry.
Keith, now you're a former cop in New York State on Long Island. Let me ask you this. Frank says this interview that these two gentlemen from McHenry County came to the prison to conduct with him about a double homicide, relatively serious thing. It lasted about a half hour. They asked no questions and took no notes. Does that seem a little odd to you for a double homicide investigation, for an interview with a person who's naming the killer to be conducted in that manner? A half-hour interview with no notes and no questions.
Doesn't seem a little strange. It seems very strange.
Yeah.
I can understand them looking at this gentleman, Glenn, because you would look close to home for something like that. And usually, like they say, so many of the homicides are created by family members or known people. So I could understand them looking at Glenn. But when you get handed something like this, like Frank gave them on a silver platter, and to walk away, something is very wrong.
Well, my belief is that, you know, that town, that particular town was outfit controlled. Outfit means, you know, organized crime. And I sort of felt in my heart that the outfit didn't want my testimony and that deal there to be credible, for the fact that then I would be a very, very credible witness against who I was testifying against.
I asked you once at one of your presentations here in Las Vegas, Frank, about it, and you outright said the town was mobbed up.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
That's what I'm finding out.
Frank, we talked a little bit about Larry and about the triple homicide and all that, but you knew Larry quite well. I mean, can you tell us a little more about him, what kind of guy he was?
I met him in the Illinois State Penitentiary. We both worked in the psychiatric department for the criminally insane. And Larry should have been locked up in there. He was a nurse, and he worked directly for the psychiatrist, you know. And he was a genius. Larry definitely had the IQ of a genius. But that don't mean nothing. Sometimes these guys with these high IQs are more capable of doing violent crimes than a dummy. And I met him in there, and I knew he had 125 years for a triple murder that he committed. It was over, from what I understand, $2.38 or something. He thought they were taking advantage of him, so... That just goes to show you what type of guy he was. He hated for anybody to make a fool out of him. And he said that he would probably get out earlier because his father had a lot of money and it was already set up with the courts. And I thought, well, 125 years ain't a bad sentence for three murders. And he could go up to the parole board. So right then and there, I knew this guy had his father had a little clout and his father had money. And Larry did make a parole, but when we were working up in the detention hospital, there was a lot of violence up in that hospital because we used to work with these people and we could hurt them at any time we wanted. And Larry took advantage of that with these inmates up there, I mean. So eventually he got busted out of the job. So instead of putting them in the hole, they put them on the farm. They rewarded him. And then he, when he got out of jail, he came to my lounge and he wanted to hang around with us guys. But soon after, I moved to Las Vegas.
And now, so Newman had on his credentials here, his resume, he had the triple homicide we talked about from the 50s over this couple of bucks and change. He had the murder of Paul's dad and Patricia Freeman. And then he did another murder, too, that you were aware of because you would give him information about a possible score, which you thought was going to be a kind of a simple robbery.
It was supposed to be a simple armed robbery, and Larry decided to make a murder out of it, a murder robbery. And I asked him why he'd done that. I said that was, you know, I was very angry. I didn't know he'd done the actual murder until he arrived where I was in Las Vegas with the merchandise. And he told me things went wrong and he had to kill him. And I was very upset and I screamed and hollered at him, but what good did it do? It was already done. And he explained to me that, well, he didn't want to have any witnesses around. And him and Wayne performed this murder on this guy. They violently killed him. You know, Larry stabbed him repeatedly in the back with a bayonet that was hanging on the wall, strangled him with a hanger wire. They broke a vase on this guy's head, what they did to this poor guy. All for $25,000. I mean, that's not worth anybody. That's not worth it, you know.
No.
So, but it was done, and you know, it was done and over with, and you can't bring it back, you know. And then Larry stood out there and wanted to work for me and work for the little guy, meaning Tony.
I have a question, Frank. Frank, do you think he did any other homicides other than those six?
He probably did, but you know, he never talked about them. If you know, and I wasn't about to ask him about it anymore because I knew what kind of guy he was. It was bad enough I knew what he'd done already, you know. And I would have to think about him maybe thinking about that, maybe kill me, you know. But he probably did other killings. I know Tony wanted him to, Splatcher wanted him to kill this guy, Ernie DeVino, that was in our crew because Tony thought the guy was sort of weak. And Larry wanted to do it. And then I told him about it, and he's all tickled pink. And I said, how are you going to do it? And he said, well, I'll make believe like we're going on a burglary. He said, well, get him in an empty house. He said, I'll kill him and cut him up in the bathtub. He said, then I'll put him in plastic bags and I'll dump him in Lake Mead. They'll never find him. And I said, well, this guy's a sick bastard, you know. And that was the end of that, you know. But Tony stopped it before it got all the way. And then Larry was sort of upset because he had, I think, $500 into the boat that he had to fix up to carry the body parts. So he was really upset about that.
So Larry Newman isn't really your warm, fuzzy guy. I mean,
you know, physically, the guy was in tremendous shape. He used to do 1,000 sit-ups a day in jail. So, he'd probably be around 80-some years old right now if he were alive. And thank God he's not. But he was physically in tremendous shape.
Wow.
Hey, Denny.
Yes,
Bob. I wanted to make a point about the Robert Brown murder. That was the murder that Larry went away for life. I don't know if this ever happened, but in a newspaper article in the Las Vegas Sun, Larry was being represented by Adam Bourgeois. And Adam Bourgeois had every intention of subpoena Hendel, the lead investigator of my father's murder investigation, to go ahead and testify on the behalf of Larry Newman, the triple murder, in another murder.
There you go. They're going to talk about me and say I was an incredible witness. That's all they were going to do.
Yeah, Bourgeois didn't like you, Frank.
Which one didn't like me?
Adam Bourgeois, the attorney.
Yeah, the attorney.
Them two people I visited me, they were on the, I believe that they were on a take. You know, I can't prove it, but I think they were on the take. They had to be. How could they let that go? I mean, I told them, I detailed it out for them, exactly what I was told from Tommy Amato. Where Larry threw the gun when he was through, you know, and everything. And I never heard of them going drag the lake for the gun. So.
Wow.
They even stopped Tommy Amato. They locked him up. He was locked up in McHenry County overnight. They caught him that night. He was, I don't know, by staying by that Debbie's house, Larry's ex-wife, and he was arrested. They let him out. And he had a warrant on him in Las Vegas. He had a warrant out for him in Las Vegas. So it was weird. You know, everything was really weird.
Well, I got a little more information on that. They actually set up roadblocks near the bar and stuff. And they were looking for witnesses. So he did have a couple warrants. And so he was picked up. And I do have those warrants. But what's fascinating is that the interview that was conducted by George Hendel and I believe Sergeant Larry Massaro, I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, the interview of Tommy Amato does not exist anywhere in that file. And again, it's the Adam Bourgeois connection is what I call it. When Adam Bourgeois shows up, the lights go out. And Adam
Mission
Bourgeois,
Impossible. They destroy the evidence.
Well, Adam Bourgeois represented back then, he represented Tommy Amato, Larry Newman, and Debbie Newman.
Oh, okay.
All right, so you got that. And whenever Adam Bourgeois shows up, things go really quiet. Because you can see that they were talking about Debbie and Larry, or talking about Debbie, and then Adam Bourgeois shows up, and then boom, she falls off the radar. So the only reason I know that the investigation did exist is through the FBI reports.
Oh, you did some good work there.
I did release my appeal online. So if folks are looking for it, it's in the Murder McHenry Facebook group, and it's also on my website, McHenryCounty1981.com. But I've included my appeal, why I'm appealing, and FBI reports, and believe it or not, more evidence that Hendel is connected to the outfit.
Wow, that's great.
Will anybody do anything about it? That's a different story.
Well, they're all dead. Probably all them guys that were active at the time are all dead or, you know, buried. You know, they died of natural deaths or they died in prison. Anybody that was involved, I would think. You know, I don't know.
Well, we know George Hendel's passed. I don't know about Ted Floro. I don't know that he was corrupted or not, but he seems somebody that we would want to talk to.
Just my thoughts, and we'll have Keith weigh in on this as well. If the state's attorney is there, now he's in charge. He said, I believe, would be making the call on whether or not they're going to do anything as far as the prosecution and kind of directing the police and cooperating with them and talking with them about what they think and what they need and all this kind of thing.
Why did they go after Debbie? That's what I don't understand. She was dead. When you call that, when you cover up a crime?
Aiding and abetting.
Aiding and abetting. Why didn't they go after her for aiding and abetting?
Good question, Paul.
Yeah, well, I mean, she was definitely interviewed in 2009, and I have to think that they didn't feel strong enough, and it was 28 years later. I don't think they felt strong enough for the case that they could put up against her, and she's going to squeak on by, but she knows what she did.
Yeah, she sure does. She's the one that initiated the whole thing.
Absolutely.
Keith, she lives in Kentucky, you know. So,
yep.
Keith, do you think both the prosecutor, the state's attorney, and the detective, the lead detective that went out and talked to Frank, it almost seems to me they would both had to have been totally incompetent, or both had some other pressure on them, or be on the take, or whatever, because it seems like otherwise one of them would have said, hey, this is BS. We got to talk to this Newman guy. We got to get him in here and, you know, do a thorough investigation. So for both of them to basically ignore this is very troubling to me.
I mean, even if you gave Hendel every consideration for not knowing what he was supposed to be doing at the time, you still have to look at that state's attorney or district attorney, whatever they care to call him, with what he was told by Frank. Why wasn't it presented to a grand jury for them to decide if there was
absolutely
enough to warrant a prosecution?
Absolutely.
I mean, this man has a doctorate in law, supposedly, anyhow.
And
everything goes to a grand jury. You're supposed to be able to indict a ham sandwich in a grand jury. They always told you.
Anybody can get indicted in the grand jury.
Yeah, anything can be said in a grand jury and stuff. And it's not that you're convicting them, just that there's enough reasonable cause to bring it to a trial. There certainly seems to be, from everything I read and working on this book for 3.5 years, there had to be enough to bring to a trial.
Yeah, just a mass cover-up. A lot of money was spread around, I'm sure. A lot of money was spread around, I'm sure.
And
probably all revolved around trying to ruin my credibility, because if they come out and they did something about that at that time, that would have made my credibility look real good, and it would have made it stronger in court against everybody I was testifying in. So that's what it was on. That's the bottom line there.
And what else is funny about this is going back to this Adam Bourgeois. He had his license suspended at some point for practicing law after this. And he eventually became a Ouija board person that he's well known for handling Ouija boards now.
Ouija boards?
I don't know. Maybe that's how they solve cases there with Ouija boards. But
He was a black gentleman, wasn't he?
Pardon me? Paul?
Was he a black gentleman?
Yes.
Nuts.
And his son is a judge, or was a judge in Chicago.
Yeah, because on the trial with Larry, when I had him up there for that murder, one of the jurors was a black guy, and they were making a lot of eye contact with one another. And that's what got that case retried again, because the jury was a whole lot of guy, and they were sort of on that. I can't even pronounce his name, Adam Bourgeois or whatever it is, because he made contact with this juror. So they had to retry the case, and that's when they got Larry finally was found guilty.
Oh.
Frank,
Sorry, Danny.
I just wanted to point out, because a lot of the listeners may not be familiar with this, but Frank, I'm going to describe what your situation was roughly at that time. Then, if I make any mistakes, you can correct me. But Frank had just made a deal with the government to become a cooperating witness and enter the witness protection program. One of the conditions for him to get into the witness protection program and have this deal go through is he had to tell the truth. He had to tell everything he knew about any crime, any criminal activity, not only that he personally did, but that any of his associates or acquaintances did. And if he was caught in a lie, if the feds, when they checked his stories, if he lied to them, the whole deal could be off. He could have ended up in prison for life as a persistent felon. Certainly the outfit guys could have maybe gotten a hold of him and gotten rid of him. So Frank really had nothing to gain and everything to lose by wanting to make up some wild story about Newman.
But, you know, I had blanket immunity. That means I could talk about murders that I was involved in. And I would be a damn fool to tell a lie because I had exposed all these other crimes I committed. Then I would have been tried for different murders. So there was no reason for me to lie or dream up any stories. I wasn't trying to make myself look, you know, great. I just wanted to get the truth out there. And I said as best as I could what I remembered, and I have never lied since. I mean, I've never lied, really, in there at all. I had too much to lose.
And your testimony, at least in part or mainly, ended up getting Newman convicted of that the jeweler murder, the Brown murder.
Right. Put him away for life.
Oh. Hey, Frank.
After.
I got a quick question for Frank. Do you know if George Hendel was ever actually subpoenaed and actually testified in that case?
And no, I don't. I don't know nothing about that. I just know the detectives that came to me later on in later years. I don't even remember their names. When you more or less reopened it, Paul, and then these detectives all wanted to talk to me, and they seemed like they were pretty good guys. I mean, they worked on it. They even went out there to see Tommy. I don't know. I can't say if they were on the take, but they even, you know, getting the only one they had to go after would have been Debbie, because Larry, I think, had passed by then. And it was too hard to get her on aiding and abetting. And they couldn't, so they just left the case as Larry was the one that, you know, that did it. And, you know, like, in other words, he's dead. What can we do about it, you know?
Yeah, well, they left the case open, though.
Yeah, well, they left it open, but, you know.
No, it's still open today.
It's good to let it show, you know, that he was the one that literally killed them two people in there, you know, your father and that poor girl. I know the whole deal. He told me every damn thing that happened in there was horrible. You know.
Let me interrupt just a second. Kim, do we have a question or anything from the chat room or a caller?
Yes, we do. We have an old friend of Paul's on the line. Her name is Marianne. And let me get Marianne on the line. Marianne, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead with what you wanted to say.
Well, I've known Paul a long time, and I want to say I hope he keeps on spreading the story because it needs to be told. And I'm ever so impressed with him, what a gentleman he is. And, I mean, he grew up with my kids. He was one of my kids. They hung out at my house. And I'm very proud of you, Paul, and keep on spreading the story.
Thank you, Mrs.
Paul.
Day.
Yeah.
Yes.
Paul, you know who Marianne is then. That's
oh,
good.
I most definitely do.
Oh, I could tell you a few stories, but I won't.
Thank you. That is so much better. Thank you. Yeah, I grew up with her son Brett, and I know her son Ross and Scott too.
Yeah, he knows all of us.
Well,
good memories. Good memories.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you very
so
much for the call, ma'am.
For calling.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Mrs. K.
Paul, now, you know, it's a very, what this lady just said is certainly key, is getting the story out, because, you know, a lot of people, if you were sitting chatting in a tavern or something or a coffee shop and they heard the story, they think it was a fiction. They'd say, well, this guy's got a very vivid imagination. This is America. That can't happen here.
Right.
And I think that's why it's very important, as she said, that as frustrating as I'm sure it is at times and so forth, boy, but your tenacity in keeping this going and letting people know what not only can happen, it actually did happen to you.
What I think about is, you know, The Sharp and the Freeman family, where they are is where they are. But what I think about is the next tragedy. And we don't want other community members going through what the Sharp and the Freemans did. And the only way to do that is to talk about the story out in the open and demand transparency of the investigation. And that's what we need to do. And especially if you're from Illinois, that's what you need to do. You don't know what's going on behind the scenes, you know, and this case exemplifies what can go on behind the scenes. And, you know, we had the Chicago outfit pulling the strings.
And that's what they did. Well, listen, Paul, I have to go. Thank you for inviting me on your show. And
thanks for coming.
If you ever get that far down the road where you absolutely need to get on a stand and testify to what I heard from Larry Newman, I'd be glad to do it.
I appreciate it, Frank. I appreciate everything you've done for me so far. I really appreciate it very much, and so does my family.
Okay, Paul. Take it easy. Be good, okay?
All right. You take it easy.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
All right. See you all.
Thank
okay.
you,
Bye-bye.
Frank. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, Frank.
Wow, what a great surprise that was.
I thought you'd like that.
Definitely, definitely.
Now we've pretty much covered what kind of guy Larry Newman is, or was, I should say, and some of, at least back in the initial investigation with Hendel and all this kind of thing. Now let's talk about the book. You decided, Paul, that you wanted to write and tell the story of what happened. And the title of the book is Murder in McHenry. And what's it been out now, about 3 weeks or so?
Yeah, about that.
Okay. So you and Keith got together and decided to collaborate on the book. And as part of your research, you and Keith both had to try to get information from, well, a variety of sources, but one of those sources was McHenry County. So why don't you go first, then we'll have Keith after you talk about your experiences and dealing with the system.
Well, that's really quick. We filed twice for the Freedom of Information Act, or Keith did, and we were turned down. I filed for the Freedom of Information Act after the book was already in the hands of the publisher, and I think the political climate changed a little bit in McHenry, as now the lead investigator worked his way to undersheriff. He has now put his hat in for sheriff, and I'm thinking they probably didn't want me around in 2014, so just give me my information.
And shut you up. And then hopefully you go away.
Yeah, that's what they think.
But that's not what is happening.
No, and they should know better.
Keith, now you filed these first couple of requests, Freedom of Information requests, and they were turned down. What was your transactions like? What excuse did they give?
They just basically told me I was not entitled to them. And I had sent off the first one. It was rejected. I refiled. And I kind of got in a letter that said, like, I told you, you're not entitled to this. Along those lines. I had sent it to Paul afterwards, after we were done with the notes. I gave him all of my notes to hold on to. But, you know, it was just outright. My idea was, as a cop, I'm going to give them, as a former cop, I'm going to give them a fair shake in this thing to present me with the evidence. And they refused to do so. Yet under the Freedom of Information Act, I should have been entitled to that, as far as I could see.
So they were not apparently very anxious to get the information out to you.
No, not at all.
And the question that comes to my mind is, now I understand that there are our rules and regulations regarding the release of information. I understand all that. Some of them are good. Some of them, I think, can serve to go the other way. And as an example, let me say this, that I have dealt with police agencies, and I'm talking about when on our Crime Wire show when we're talking to victims' families, murder victims. An unsolved homicide, of course, there's no statute of limitations and so on, and as long as that case is kept open, the investigators or the agency can refuse to release information with the idea that the information is confidential, it could jeopardize an ongoing investigation, and so on and so forth. And I understand there's a lot of times that undoubtedly is true. But, and this is a big but, that same ability to deny, that same reason for denying the release of the information can also be used to cover up inactivity, incompetence, malfeasance, or worse. Do you agree with that, Keith, that can be a double-edged sword?
I completely agree with you, Danny.
And it's very tough. And, you know, the other thing I think is that most of us, fortunately, don't have to go through what Paul has and is going through as far as having that type of an atrocity affect us directly. So you don't have a big groundswell of a bunch of people out there saying, you know, percentage-wise of the country, saying, oh, yeah, this is wrong or this shouldn't happen. It's a relatively, thankfully, small percentage of people. And most of us like to have faith in our law enforcement officers and agencies. We like to think and believe they're going to do the right thing. And, again, the vast majority of them probably do. But there are always exceptions. And it's unfortunate that the victim's family that is fighting the system is relatively alone. You know what I mean? It's
they're victimized twice. They're victimized by the crime, and then they're victimized by the system.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And that's a shame. And like I say, most people, if you told them this, what happened to Paul or Paul's dad and Patricia Freeman, they would think that it just couldn't happen. I mean, a lot of time, I think a lot of people would not believe it. And that to me is very frustrating as well. And if you get caught up in that situation, by the time you realize that perhaps the agency handling the investigation or the individual in that agency handling the investigation maybe isn't quite up to speed, it might be too late to do anything about it. And that's really an unfortunate thing.
I agree.
Paul?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, you know, and that's why you got to keep pushing and try to get whatever information that you need and don't let up, you know, but it is a real uphill battle, you know, and I worry about victims that don't have all this circus, that don't have a crazy story to tell, you know, other than, you know, they lost a loved one or something like that. You know, the community really needs to be engaged with what goes on in their own government to make sure that what happens is reflective of the community. And I think the folks in McHenry, they look to the neighbors of the left and to the right and think that those are the same people that are leading them, but that's just not the facts. You have to engage and know who's up front and what they're doing.
Yeah, you know, it's coincidentally, over the weekend, I went to an event here in Las Vegas, and Bill Cosby was the keynote speaker. It was a Citizens Against Homicide function, first annual conference. And I listened to Mr. Cosby's talk. He talked for about 90 minutes. Of course, his son was murdered. And he went through, well, a lot of things. And one of the points he made, he says, look, he says, don't feel guilty for keeping on your government officials. He said, yep, he said, they're not going to want to hear from you every day. They're not going to want to hear from you at all in some cases. He said, tough. He said, the public, the families of these victims, you have to stay on them because they're not always doing what they claim they're doing. And he said, you've got to keep after them. You got to shine the light on them and let people know, you know, get like you're doing, get the word out. And it was not only police agencies, it was some social workers. He said, you know, you read stories where they go to these homes looking supposedly for some complaint that there's an abuse situation or whatever. He says, and what happens, he says, is they get there, he says, and they're so anxious to be nice people, you know, social worker types. He said they don't bother to really do an investigation. And he said that's, you know, he said, it's not about making them feel good. That's not their job. It's about them finding out whether someone is in danger, whether someone's being abused. So he didn't attack the government, but he made it clear that it's up to us as citizens to make sure we hold these people accountable, the police, the social service types, and not to feel guilty for doing it.
I agree 100%. 100%. You know, we had signals, you know, back in 82 when I gathered the files for my father's case. I see that my uncle called the FBI in 1982, concerned that McHenry County wasn't doing what they were supposed to. And we did have news articles that trickled back to us about Frank and testifying. And, you know, now we know we really should have pushed the issue. But my mom called George Hendel and said, you know, what's with this mobster in the papers? You know, was my husband gunned down by the mob? And he told her, don't listen to what you read in the papers. If you need any information, contact me directly. that probably yeah. should have been a warning sign, you know. And I know my mom, you know, feels really taken by this, you know, having the facts of what they are now.
Sure.
You know, you can't help but feel some regret with that.
Yeah, the old trust me. Trust me.
Exactly.
You know, let me just mention real quickly, too, that I've encountered other families, again, primarily through the Crime Wire show, where they start out believing that their case is being looked at and handled appropriately. And there are certain options that a family might have, such as filing a civil wrongful death suit to get the person of interest, if you will, or the suspect on record in a deposition or in a courtroom, even though it's civil. But they don't realize until the statute, in a lot of cases, it's 1 or 2 years, depending on the state, that you have to file this action. And a lot of these people don't realize until that statute has run and is too late that maybe the investigation is not actually being done at all. And then it's too late for them to do anything.
Yeah,
that's very unfortunate.
Now, we're just about out of time, so what I want to do is, again, the name of the book is Murder in McHenry, Paul Sharp and Keith Bettinger, and the book is doing very well, am I correct?
It's doing very well.
It is. We sold out on Amazon in 2 days, and for those of you that have been patiently waiting, today they finally got more stock, thank God.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Okay. We are out of time, so we're going to have to wrap it up. Paul and Keith, thanks so much for being on the show with us, and I hope you'll come back again. Paul, especially if there's any updates and as you get more information from your appeal and so forth, we'd love to have you back on. And I'd like to thank everyone for listening, and don't forget to check out BearMediaConsultants.com, the place to go if you want to get connected. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Good night, gentlemen. Good night, Producer
Ken.
Good night,
you
all. Good
night,
Keith. Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night,
everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.